You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast, Navigating Treatment Sequencing in HER2-Mutant Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer. Given the new approvals of HER2-targeted oral tyrosine kinase inhibitors, in addition to HER2 antibody drug conjugates, or ADCs, strategies to find the most effective sequence of HER2-directed therapies is a frequently debated topic. My name is Dr. Eric Singhi. I'm a thoracic medical oncologist, and I'm very pleased to be joined by my colleague, Dr. Bruna Pellini, who is the chief of thoracic medical oncology at Baptist Health Herbert Wertheim Cancer Institute from beautiful Miami, Florida. Dr. Pellini, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Singhi.
Absolutely, and thanks for sticking with us now for our final episode of this three-part series. We're going to be discussing, of course, HER2-directed therapies, specifically some of the newer agents in this space that are approved for our patients with advanced HER2-mutant non-small cell lung cancer. We'll talk about patient-specific factors, disease-specific factors, molecular factors. How do we use all that to truly guide our treatment decision-making in the first line and beyond? So let's get right into it. I want to learn a little bit more, Dr. Pellini, the stories behind these approvals. And the way that these stories happen is through landmark clinical trials, right? And so talk us through the story of how trastuzumab deruxtecan, an antibody drug conjugate, T-DXd. Tell us the story behind the approval.
Yes, so T-DXd was the first drug, well, not really the first, but the second drug ADC approved for lung cancer with HER2 mutations. But before that, we didn't see a lot of excitement in terms of disease control and activity. So I will consider the first best one in class. So in 2022, that's when T-DXd was approved in the second line setting and beyond for advanced non-small cell lung cancer. So a little over 100 patients were treated in that study, and the overall response rate was 50%, and the median PFS was 10 months, which was super exciting for these patients in the second line setting and beyond. The initial median PFS was around a little over 8 months, but the final analysis did show that was 10 months, and the median duration of response was 16.8 months. So really exciting. We were using this drug as an IV antibody drug conjugate. It's given every 3 weeks. It does have the toxicities associated with the payload, so chemotherapy type of toxicities, but it did have some cases of interstitial lung disease, which was something that we were concerned and we have to monitor. Then zongertinib came along, and it was studied in the second line setting as well as the first line setting. And it was a little over 70 patients that were treated in each of these cohorts that were treatment naive or the previously treated. And the overall response rate was so exciting. 71% in the second line and beyond, and 76% in the first line setting. And the median PFS in the second line setting and beyond was already super exciting. It was 12.4 months, which was something that we see in other oncogene-driven tumors. We hadn't seen this yet with a targeted therapy, a pill for HER2 mutations. And the median PFS in the first line setting was 14 months. So again, even a little bit better than the second line and beyond setting. So that led to the approval of zongertinib. So it was the first targeted therapy approved in the first line setting for HER2 mutant non-small cell lung cancer. And as a matter of fact, as of now, it's still the only HER2 directed therapy approved in the first line setting. And savabertinib, a few months after zongertinib approval happened, it was approved as well. Overall response rate is similar, is in the 70s as well, 71% in the second line and beyond cohort, 71% as well, 67%, sorry, in the second line. And in terms of median PFS, savabertinib in second line is around 8 months, and then the first line setting is around 13 months. Differences between these agents, if you're going to use them in second line, where all of them are approved in second line, toxicities, obviously, and the way you administer the drugs. So sevabertinib is oral, is given twice a day. Zongertinib is oral, is once a day. T-DXd is IV every 3 weeks. Sevabertinib causes a lot of diarrhea. That's the main side effect. Zongertinib doesn't have that problem in terms of diarrhea being as high. Is a very well-tolerated drug. You have to be mindful of the liver enzymes. Some cardiac ejection fraction monitoring needs to happen. Rash can happen. And T-DXd, really, you have to worry about the interstitial lung disease, which is something very unique, and then it can cause diarrhea like any chemo. So I think those are the pearls around those drugs.
Yeah, that was a masterclass on the trials and the data for all three of these drugs that we now have in this space. Frontline, yes, and also second line and beyond. So I think that's really important. And I really like how you highlighted the different aspects of, one, how the drug is given, and second, the toxicity profiles, right? They're different. And so, you know, let's touch base a little bit on two of the toxicities that you mentioned. The first is ILD, right? And with the DESTINY-Lung01 and then DESTINY-Lung02 studies, we were learning about ILD without trying to compromise response rates. And I think that's how we found that correct dose, if you will, of being able to preserve the response rate but reduce the ILD, specifically with trastuzumab deruxtecan. Can you talk us through sort of that risk profile of ILD and why we worry as thoracic medical oncologists about that?
Yeah, so when the DESTINY-Lung studies were designed, the dosage that was tested was the dose that we give for breast cancer patients or patients with breast cancer. And that did not go well in our patients with lung cancer. The rates of ILD were too high. And again, it doesn't make sense. In breast, the cancer cells, they're not in the lung most of the time, right? I mean, there can have mets, but that's not the primary tumor. There's not a huge disease burden there. For lung cancer, your ADC is going straight to the lung where a lot of the disease is at. So ILD was problematic for the higher dose. And then the 5.4 milligram per kilogram dose is the one approved for T-DXd in lung cancer. But most of the ILD, which is around 15% rate, is grade 1 or grade 2, which means that, you know, for a grade 3, that's a hospitalization. Grade 2, though, which is something very unique of T-DXd and ADCs, you cannot give the drug again if you have a grade 2 ILD. But a grade 1, yes, you can continue.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, right? Because that's a little bit different from what we do for immunotherapy if we develop ILD pneumonitis, right? Grade 2, sometimes we consider a rechallenge. With ADCs, our guidelines tell us, hey, we can't rechallenge, right? And so I think that's a big conundrum. And why it's so important to emphasize that zongertinib actually had zero drug-related ILD cases in previously treated patients. I think it was only 2 grade 2 cases in the first-line cohort, so still very minimal. And sevabertinib had zero ILD across all the cohorts. And so exciting to be able to see these drugs not have those toxicities, but there are different ones. You mentioned diarrhea, you mentioned rash. There's also LFT abnormalities we need to be watching for, particularly with zongertinib for the first 12 weeks, right? Anything else you want to mention about the adverse event profile?
Yeah, so all of these drugs have side effects, right? Let's be honest. But in terms of the burden of high grade, so a grade 3 or higher, treatment-related adverse event, with the caveat of cross-trial comparison, the numbers are lower in the zongertinib trial. So grade 3 treatment-related AEs in the zongertinib trial is around 19%. Sevabertinib is in the mid-20s, and then T-DXd is almost 40%. So I think this is something for us to be mindful. If you don't get the drug, you don't get the benefit. So understanding that the burden of toxicity is extremely important. And also, I think, Dr. Singhi, the type of toxicity, right? Because, I mean, of course, ILD is super scary, but diarrhea is limiting for a patient's life. And grade 2 diarrhea is limiting for a patient's life because it can be 4 to 7 bowel movements a day. So it's not something that we can just brush it off and say, oh, the grade 3 diarrhea rates are very low. Yeah, but what about your grade 2?
Yeah, no, and I completely agree, you know. And the other thing I like that you mentioned and hinted on, I'm going to emphasize it a lot now, is that the time toxicity aspect, right? So in a disease, particularly where a lot of patients are often young, they're working, they're raising families, you name it, the difference between an IV infusion every 3 weeks with, you know, mandatory ILD monitoring versus being able to take a daily pill at home is not just a convenience, it's a matter of quality of life, I think, too, right? And so there's a real advantage with a lot of these oral TKIs, or the two oral TKIs right now, right? No infusion visits, no technical pre-medication requirements, dramatically lower ILD risk. I mean, it's nice to be able to think about all of these things, but of course, counseling is really important. And helping patients understand, you know, some of these other toxicities may develop and how do we manage them, when to alert your care team, how to get through this hopefully long experience with the particular drug, right? I want to talk to you now about, or go back rather, to what we hinted on with episode 2, intracranial activity of these drugs. It's a huge unmet need for this patient population, given the high incidence of brain metastases. Can you talk us through some of the details of what we know about the intracranial efficacy of these drugs?
Kudos to BI that produces zongertinib, because they really did dedicated studies in patients with active brain metastases. So it's still small numbers, only 30 patients, but that's the prospective data that we have, and that's the largest cohort of patients that we have data on. So zongertinib, with the current approved dose, the intracranial overall response using RANO brain metastases for active brain metastasis, 47%. That's the number to remember. And for patients that did not receive a prior brain radiotherapy, it was even higher. In this 23 patients that they analyzed, was 57%. And when you look at the median intracranial PFS for zongertinib, was 8.2 months. And they had patients that develop CNS as the initial site of progression in 11% of the cases. Okay. Now, savobertinib, we don't have data published yet. So this is pending. Bayer did, it's conducting the study, so kudos to them, but we don't have the data. So I cannot talk about intracranial overall response rate or median intracranial PFS with savobertinib because this data is just not available. The only thing that I can say is that 5% of the patients in their study that did not have brain metastasis end up developing brain metastasis, that I can tell you. And when it comes to AstraZeneca, they did provide us some data from a subgroup analysis. So again, it's not a cohort to test this. 14 patients were studied in DESTINY-Lung02. 50% response rate was noted in the brain, so intracranial overall response rate. And the median intracranial PFS was 7.8 months with T-DXd. So this is also a drug that does have some CNS penetration, so something to remember. But again, it's an IV drug, and it's not yet approved in the first-line setting. So if you see a patient with CNS metastases that has a HER2 mutation in the first-line setting, the only agent that we really have the most robust data or the strongest prospective CNS evidence is zongertinib.
That's a perfect summary, yeah. So I think I'll summarize your summary one more time, that there is hope for patients even with active brain metastases with HER2 mutated disease. Data is clearest right now for zongertinib. We also have impressive real world data as well too from T-DXd, and then savobertinib's intracranial story is still being written, but there is some excitement there and some more to come in that space. I want to talk to you next about treatment sequencing, because now we have options, right? So before February of 2026, when we got that accelerated approval of frontline zongertinib, we did not have an oral TKI in this space, and we were giving patients chemotherapy plus or minus immunotherapy. Objective response rates, Dr. Pliny, were quite modest, right? 35, 40%. And now we're hearing numbers like 76%, right? Which is incredible for patients. And that really sets the scene of why we're both so excited about these drugs evolving in this space. But talk us through now, as of after February 2026, what are we doing with sequencing? How do we pull which drug, when, for which patient?
Yes, excellent question. We don't have robust data on sequencing that. I'll preface by saying that. But what we know is, A, if you use zongertinib in the first-line setting, because it's the only approved drug for HER2 mutations in the first-line setting, well, not the only, the only oral, I'll say, drug approved, right? So you should not use savobertinib as the next line of therapy, because there's no data to suggest that if you're using zongertinib and the patient develops disease progression, there will be activity with Savabertin. So just don't do that. Now, you can absolutely use T-DXd after zongertinib if you're using zongertinib in the first line setting. So that sequencing is allowed. Now, if you didn't give any of these agents in the first line setting because you didn't know of the data and you gave these patients, let's say, a platinum doublet, then you have three options in the second line setting. You could give zongertinib or savabertinib or T-DXd. And you could use T-DXd first and then go to an oral agent, or you could use the oral agent and go to T-DXd. This is based on guidelines. Now, if you want to ask my opinion of how I think we should sequence, I will always say that I think about my patient's quality of life a lot and not having to come to the cancer center every 3 weeks, having to do labs. And many times, depending where you're practicing, patients have to come one day for labs and then another day for the visit and then another day for the infusion. You're basically sparing them of three visits, right? Every 3 weeks. So even if you're monitoring the blood work and seeing the patients on oral agents, just not having that chair time is very meaningful.
Yeah, I agree, right? And so there's so much to consider here, right? Not only how well the drug is going to work, but how well is it going to work for that particular patient? How well is it going to work for their quality of life, their true experience, right? Because we want them ideally to be spending and living long lives, fulfilling lives, and being able to do what they enjoy. And I think thinking about the oral TKI advantage, of course, weighing the pros and cons of that with an ADC infusion is really important to unpack, right? So I think that's a great pearl from the clinical standpoint. I want to also ask you about resistance mechanisms and what we understand, right? Because I think that's another part of the sequencing challenge here, right? Is if we choose one drug and unfortunately they experience disease progression, why is it happening and what do we do? What information do we have right now?
I don't think we have enough data to fully understand what's happening with these tumors, especially because we don't have a lot of patients treated in the first line setting. So I think we have to learn more about it and understand what new treatment opportunities will emerge as we give more of these agents. But I'd say if your patient developed disease progression on any of these agents, rebiopsy, retest the sample for NGS. And also now we have new protein expressions that may develop. We have drugs against MET, CMET overexpression. Of course, you can still, if you have a HER2 overexpression, you could still use T-DXd in the second line, even if the tumor doesn't have a HER2 mutation, right? So I think those are things to be mindful of.
Yeah, I appreciate those pearls. You know, I've been also watching myself, Dr. Pellini, what real world case studies have been coming out, right, to help guide us and understand the biology. And it's hopefully telling us something quite promising, and that's that a tumor that escapes through a TKI, for example, through, let's say, a gatekeeper type of mutation, you can still have the antibody binding site intact, or a tumor that escapes through an ADC, through payload resistance, maybe the TKI will still work, right? The kinase domain is still active. And so I think that's why sequencing presents options. But I also echo the importance of rebiopsy, reprofiling, even checking protein overexpression, amplification. Those are going to be important pieces of the puzzle here. So thanks for guiding us on those principles. I think we're actually out of time for our final episode today. And so I wanted to thank you again for your expertise, your kindness, your clinical pearls for all of us here and how we can manage the care of patients with HER2 non-small cell lung cancer. This podcast was brought to you by Med Learning Group. Med Learning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. This is a non-promotional educational disease state awareness initiative that's supported by an independent educational grant from Boehringer Ingelheim Pharmaceuticals, Inc. Thanks for joining.